Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Dr. Tony Greco heads the prestigious Sarah Cannon Cancer Center, which is making important contributions to clinical research from within a community practice setting. I met with Dr. Greco, and before we began chatting about lung cancer, I asked him to comment on another critical area of clinical research for which he's taken a major leadership role over the years, so-called cancers of unknown primary. To begin, he commented on new concepts in the pathogenesis of this fascinating clinical syndrome.
I don't think there's one explanation for all these patients, but the most attractive theory to me is what I call an embryologic theory, okay? And this is basically cells which are misplaced, cells which during embryologic migration, of course, all the cells in our body that make up all the tissues had to migrate from a small blastosphere and grow and differentiate into all of our organs. And we know that cells are misplaced. In other words, pancreas cells could end up in a lymph node when most of their brethren went and formed the pancreas, or lung, or skin, or I could go on and on, breast, any organ in our body. Cells that make up that organ during their migration, which is really amazing, you can look at the stages of this embryologically, these cells, some of them, don't end up where they're supposed to be. Now, if they're just a breast cancer in a lymph node in the neck, you following my reasoning?
Let's take a clinical scenario. Pick a case.
Let's pick a man who has a lymph node in his left neck and no other abnormality anywhere. And the biopsy of that shows an adenocarcinoma. And he's healthy otherwise. And full workup, including endoscopy, CT scanning, PET scanning, everything's normal. Okay? Now, it's possible that that man has an occult primary somewhere else. It's an adenocarcinoma. So adenocarcinomas, this is the way traditional thinking is, can come from the GI tract. They can come from the lung. So he may have an occult small primary in one of those sites that has got, of course, spread in the bloodstream and gotten to his neck. The theory I'm talking about is a cell that was in his neck from the time he was born.
Say from the GI tract.
Yes.
So it's sort of a primary in his neck?
You can look at it that way.
That makes sense. It actually
you can look
makes
at
sense.
It that way.
Interesting.
And there is some experimental and other evidence that supports this, but this is difficult to prove other than the fact that we know that all the cells in our body arise from just a few, and within a few-week period, they diverge and migrate and move into where they're supposed to be with all the respective organs that we have as a child or an adult. Those cells, a lot of them don't complete the proper migration to where they're supposed to go. And normally, they wouldn't be cancer. They're just
sure. They're
lung cells.
That makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense.
And I think that theory is the most attractive now.
Roughly how many cases a year in the United States are there of cancer of unknown primary?
About 50,000. It's not rare.
50,000?
Yes. And let me clarify that. Probably a third to a half of those are called something else. For example, when a patient has liver metastasis and has an elevated CA19-9, a marker associated with pancreatic cancer, pancreas is absolutely normal. Half the time or more on that death certificate, it will say pancreatic cancer.
50,000 cases.
50,000, right. And I see myself two new patients a week with that diagnosis that, you know, come to me, sent to me.
And of the 50,000, how many are adenos?
It's about 70 to 80% are adeno. And then the majority, the rest of them, are poorly differentiated carcinoma. They're not differentiated into glandular formation.
And again, looking at the spectrum there, how many present with one site as opposed to multiple sites?
A minority present with one site, but they do better. It's not rare. Again, in any oncologist practice, they don't see that many of these patients. Many that they do see over the years, they often call something else.
50,000, that's a major disease. It's way more cases than a whole lot of other things we spend a lot of time on.
It's a major disease. You look at most tumor registries, it's like 2% of all cancer. And it varies from 2 to 5%. Listed, that's listed diagnosis. This is not one group of patients. This is a heterogeneous group that several of these patients, subgroups or subsets, are highly treatable. So you really have to think about that phenomenon when you see these patients rather than it's not the same as a melanoma, for instance, which is more homogeneous.
Well, I guess also is the issue of study of tissue markers, serum markers, and how that helps you.
Yes, all of those issues are important.
What are some of the things, I mean, ER, HER2, whatever?
Yes, I think from fundamentally down to lineage, I mean, epithelial markers, sometimes we have trouble even knowing whether we're dealing with sarcoma versus lymphoma versus carcinoma. So those issues are important. Then when you get more specific, I think the issue of combining that with clinical presentation. A group of patients we described many years ago that now is important people are recognizing are what's called the extragonadal germ cell cancer syndrome. Younger men usually, but can be women too, with midline disease. It's unknown primary, but if they have an elevated marker like an HCG or alpha fetoprotein, many of those now we know are actually poorly differentiated germ cell tumors, highly treatable. And that's a specific area. But the markers generally are not diagnostic of the type of cancer the patient has. I gave you an example where it frequently could be and is. But in general, they're nonspecific for various cancers.
I mean, you think about the tumors that you don't want to miss because there's a lot of, like I mentioned, you know, ER for breast cancer, for hormones, HER2 for trastuzumab. You mentioned germ cell, of course, even more so. Yeah. What other things are out there that you want to maybe make sure you don't miss?
Well, you don't want to miss lymphoma. And again, it's probably not in most pathology laboratories today, but it still occasionally is. Pathologists think it's a carcinoma, and unless the appropriate markers are done, and, you know, leukocyte common antigen's been around for years, and it's accurate, but it's not always done. If a pathologist thinks a patient has a carcinoma, they won't even do that test. So that's important still. I still see that in my practice. You don't want to confuse large cell anaplastic lymphoma. That's the most common confusion with a carcinoma when nodal involvement is the main clinical issue. You don't want to miss, you mentioned breast cancer. Axillary presentations in women are real important, but any adenocarcinoma of unknown primary in a woman, you have to be sure, and your example of HER2 new is a very good one. If it's positive, you know, it opens up not only this could be breast cancer, but it could be a therapeutic target as well. And again, it's still nonspecific, though. HER2 new can be expressed by other tumors.
Sure, sure.
And there are a number of other clinical subsets of patients that are important to recognize, a number of them. Many of these are outlined in the chapter that Dr. John Hainsworth and I wrote for DaVita's textbook.
If you would take the whole pot of everybody as, you know.
Yeah, everyone.
What's sort of the long-term prognosis?
Well, it's poor overall. But again, if you took the whole group of unknown primary cancer patients and didn't exclude a bunch of them, which we've done over the years. See, we've said, no, this neuroendocrine carcinoma is another one of unknown primary, poorly different.
Well, how about adenocarcinoma of unknown etiology? That's a big piece of it, right?
Yeah.
Take all those.
If you took all of that, and we've done these studies and looked and treated these patients, and the one-year survival is every bit as good, if not a little better, than lung cancer, advanced lung cancer.
It's not so great.
No, but I'm just saying it's in that category.
Right.
The two-year survival is around 20% of the patients. And as you go out to 5 years, it settles into 10 to 15%. So 10 to 15% of these patients, that's all the patients, survive 5 years.
Without progressive disease?
Without progressive disease. Some of them have disease that hasn't been controlled, and others don't have it or are free of disease. And again, it's a small minority.
What about 10 years?
10 years, you know, again, it fairly plateaus out at around 10%. This is all patients now, so don't.
Right.
It's not just the old patients that are debilitated with multiple bony mets. It includes single mets. It includes the group. And in fact, many of them are the best.
Yes. Do you think, incidentally, sort of segueing into lung, that a lot of these adenos of unknown primary are lung cancer?
Yes. I think that biologically, a lot of these behave like lung cancer. And some of them are, in fact, occult lung cancers, as we discussed a little earlier. Others probably have the same behavior as a lung cancer, whether they actually are arising directly from the lung cancer's bronchial mucosa or whether they arose from some other mechanism.
So let's talk a little bit about lung cancer. I want to ask you about the presentation that you're doing for the Chemo Foundation meeting on nab-paclitaxel and lung cancer. I've been kind of tracking this story first in breast cancer and now in lung cancer. Do you want to talk a little bit about the study you're presenting?
Yes. It's basically a weekly schedule of nab-paclitaxel or Abraxane. Very little data on weekly schedules. And as you know, the drug's been approved in breast cancer. It has some advantages over traditional paclitaxel. It appears to combine well with carboplatin, of course, and paclitaxel and carboplatin are still a very popular regimen, and a reasonably good regimen, relatively speaking. So this combination of weekly Abraxane or nab-paclitaxel is well tolerated, and it shows considerable activity in a phase 2 trial that we participated in and I'm presenting here at these meetings.
Can you talk more specifically about the entry criteria, the design of the study?
Yes, it was for advanced or recurrent non-small cell lung cancer patients. Patients had to be in reasonable shape overall and normal organ function. And the dose of nab-paclitaxel was 100 milligrams per meter squared per week on day 1, 8, and 15. And carboplatin was an AUC of 6 on day 1, with the courses repeated every 28 days or every 4 weeks. And we treated approximately 60 patients, advanced patients of this variety, and the response rate was around 45%, with confidence intervals around that were reasonably tight. And a well-tolerated regimen, neutropenia was the most common side effect, but this wasn't prolonged or that severe in most patients. The most troublesome side effect was sensory neuropathy. Unlike paclitaxel, more traditional paclitaxel, however, this neuropathy was more transient. This has been seen in breast cancer work as well. More sensory and transient and often resolving within several weeks, sometimes markedly decreased just within several days. But it was still problematic for patients. And so this phase 2 trial showed activity, it showed safety, and a relatively high response rate in this phase 2 trial.
I'm guessing you took care of a lot of these patients?
I've taken care of many of these patients over the years, yes.
And have you used NAB in breast cancer or in any other platform before?
No, I've used NAB in breast cancer. Again, not part of the study, the original studies, but just as off-study patient.
Overall, when you look at breast cancer patients and lung cancer patients, you mentioned the advantages that's been discussed in terms of a lack of premedication and
yes.
shorter infusion time. For patients in general and also for breast versus colon, how much of an advantage do you think this is?
Well, again, we don't have phase 3 data. In my opinion, there is an advantage of this. In breast, we have phase 3 data, and it's been approved based on a substantial advantage that's clinically important in breast cancer. We don't have that phase 3 data in lung cancer, but the toxicity and practical advantages are there, just like they are in breast cancer.
But I guess, you know, it's kind of hard to get a feel, particularly for people who haven't used the drug, in terms of what it really means to the patient. You know, are premedications really that big a deal in breast and lung cancer? Or is this shorter infusion time, at least to the patient, and of course it could be to the doc too. Is it really significant or more minor?
In my opinion, it is significant when you go from a 3-hour infusion down to, basically a very short IV infusion. Your office is cleared out quicker. You have more chair time. It's more practical for the patients not to be on corticosteroids. So there are some advantages that are real and practical in my view.
And I guess there's also been the question, which we don't have the answer to, I think even in breast cancer, which is whether or not there's a way that this drug's going to be more effective than cremaphore-based paclitaxel. And there's a lot of hypotheses about why it might at a, pharmacologic level. What do you think about that?
Well, I think in breast cancer, again, you can argue about this. The phase 3 trial did show improved efficacy in addition to slightly better toxicity profile.
I mean, they use more drug, too. I mean,
they use more
260
drug.
Per meter
yes.
square.
So whether that'll translate out into other solid tumors, I don't think we have that data yet. And those theoretical reasons are just that right now.
So when you look at your carbo-nab phase 2 study, does it seem to you that it's about the same as carbotaxol, maybe a little bit better, maybe not as good? How would you put it?
I'd say it's about the same. Now, we did go on and increase the dose to 125 milligrams per meter squared
right.
per week. Same design with about 40 patients and saw no change in the response rate and more sensory neuropathy. So I don't think there's likely to be an advantage for that higher dose.
Yeah, I know the 125 a week was used also with breast cancer. It seems like when people use it in breast weekly, they're kind of using 100. Is that what you're thinking is?
Yes, and of course, our study was combined
right.
with carboplatin, and it was well tolerated overall, even in combination.
Right.
At the 100, I think some more, based on what we've seen, a better dose.
In this lung cancer population, again, sure, we'd love to have a phase 3 study, but sort of your eyeball look at the data and sort of the patients that you took care of, how do you think the overall impact in terms of neuropathy would be comparing carbo-nab to carbo-paclitaxel, particularly maybe 2-3 months after they're finished treatment?
it would be substantially less of a clinical issue with the nab-paclitaxel.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Again, we don't have the randomized data. In breast, we do, but, you know, I don't think it was looked at carefully long-term.
You can't really figure it out.
Can't figure it out. Plus, there are other drugs that are neurotoxic. Same in lung cancer. But in my view, these were previously untreated patients. When looking at the neurotoxicity 2-3 months down the road, it was less. It recovered quicker, sensory neuropathy, with a quicker recovery than with traditional paclitaxel.
Now, how many courses did they get?
In this study, they got, as long as they weren't toxic or progressing, they continued. It ranged from 1 to 20 courses, with a median of 5.
20 courses, wow.
Yeah, and so, yeah, that was one patient course.
Yeah, but still, it's a year and a half.
Yeah, it's a long time. And, again, some would argue about whether to continue to treat.
Right.
But this is the way the study was designed traditionally.
Is that what you generally do in your practice, or do you stop?
No, I usually stop after 6 or so.
So do you think in lung cancer, because of that, really the neuropathy difference is going to play out as clinically meaningful?
I think it's possible that it will.
Interesting. Because I don't know, do you think people sort of identify neuropathy with carboplatin and lung cancer as a major clinical problem?
Well, yes. Every patient doesn't have grade 3 or grade 4 neuropathy, obviously. But people remember patients who have neuropathy. It's a particularly difficult problem to deal with.
And of course, then you've got people with diabetes and other things where you definitely don't want to make that worse.
Exactly.
Okay, so I guess the key question here is now, what about carbo, NAB, and BEV?
Yes, that study's, well, another is planned and another is ongoing. Early information may be presented on that. So that's going to be obviously something that's done.
Do we know anything about even the safety of that regimen?
I've seen some early data from another trial, and it looks to be very similar. They excluded the traditional squamous cancers and hemoptysizing patients.
How do you approach, in general, first-line chemotherapy right now in non-small cell in a non-protocol setting in your practice?
Yeah. Well, I think there are a number of regimens that are equal efficacy. I think I individualize. If patients are diabetic, for instance, or alcoholic and have any hint of neuropathy, I don't use drugs which produce neuropathy. For instance, in that particular patient, I would consider like gemcitabine and carboplatin in that particular patient.
Would you add in BEV?
In selected cases, I would, but I wouldn't necessarily across the board. I haven't accepted bevacizumab as something we have to use in every patient first line yet. Maybe I will with a little more time, a little more seasoning of the data, but there are a lot of issues, expense, bleeding, and the question of how much you really gain from this in all the patients. So you have to individualize that issue.
Well, you know, certainly I think people aren't not talking about giving bevacizumab to patients who could not have gone in this study, so you're going to eliminate brain mets and all the other stuff. So, but just putting that aside, what would you say is the major reason you might not use a patient who would otherwise be eligible among the reasons that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I think expense is one of them. The expense in relation to what you would gain has to be part of the formula, unless we're going to say it doesn't matter if we gain 3 weeks survival, we're going to use any medication, no matter how much it costs. So a line has to be drawn here somewhere. I haven't drawn it myself specifically, but it is a major issue. I don't feel like you shouldn't use it in any patient. I just think it's, first of all, you mentioned earlier, this study was highly selected. From my calculations of it and patients that I see in my own office, probably only half the patients would even be eligible.
Absolutely. And that's the number you hear.
Yeah, so that means half aren't.
Right.
And then of that other half, there are these practical issues that you
absolutely
have to. When you work in a university and someone pays for the drug out of the pharmacy, it's a little different.
Absolutely.
So there are many other issues. If this produced 8 to 10 month median survival difference, that is a major difference. This is 2 months. This is 2 months. Now, that doesn't mean every patient only gets 2 months, but some only get 1 month.
Sure.
And some get 4 months, like you suggested. I'm going to use it in good performance status patients who otherwise would fit the criteria, but I still think we have to be careful about this.
You know, it's interesting, this performance status thing, because that was part of the entry criteria.
It was.
Yet, I think about a 60-year-old, previously healthy person who has, you know, rapidly progressive tumor that's symptomatic. Would you want to use BEV?
Well, I think it makes some sense to use it, although it wasn't studied in that setting,
right,
as you mentioned. Performance status 2 were excluded entirely.
Right.
But your point is a good point. That patient may need the drug more than someone who doesn't have such a rapidly proliferative disease.
I asked Bob Livingston on our breast cancer series recently, I said, if NAB was the same cost as paclitaxel, what would you do? He said, I would never use paclitaxel.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't like the word never, but yes, I agree overall with that.
I.e. that it's the cost.
The cost is a major issue when you have an alternative that's fairly similar, although perhaps slightly inferior. And again, all of these drugs, eventually the cost will fall. That's the interesting irony of this whole discussion. They all fall because they become generic and then another competitor comes in.
Interesting. So let's just track out a little around the rest of lung cancer and pick up on other things that might be going on with Sarah Cannon or thoughts that you have. Certainly one of the biggest stories in lung cancer right now, and this ties into Bev, is the adjuvant Bev trial that ECOG's trying to launch. And I don't know if there are any other major efforts going on with adjuvant trials in the U.S.
The Tarceva one in patients that are positive for the epidermal growth factor receptor based on immunohistochemistry and FISH testing.
Right.
I think that the targeting will become more specific in years to come. I think if one targeted only those patients with exon 19 and exon 21 mutations, that the results would be remarkably improved with the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the oral Tarceva, for instance.
Well, what about just non-smokers?
Well, we already know that's true, and many of them have these
mutations.
Right. But what I'm saying is that adjuvant trial is picking up a lot of patients who are expressing epidermal growth factor receptor, but it's not driving their cancer. So I still think that that's a good way of selecting, but we can select them even better than that, but we're not to the point technically where that's feasible.
Right. So right now, for example, I don't know how often you see non-smokers, people who've never smoked, or maybe oligosmokers, 15-pack years, et cetera, in your practice. Right now, when you see them, for example, with metastatic disease, what's your algorithm?
Well, usually erlitinib or Tarceva is going to be right on the top of the list.
Really? Before chemo?
Yes, or with it, even with it. I know the data with chemotherapy doesn't show, but that was unselected. Well, not an enriched population.
Right.
We don't have a lot of data. We only have anecdotal data on chemo plus Tarceva in this group. My bias is it's going to be even better. But, you know, you're not going to cure these patients, and Tarceva alone would be a reasonable first choice in a non-smoking woman with adenocarcinoma.
So same patient now in the adjuvant setting, would you consider erlotinib?
With a non-smoker?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I would. Again, there's no good data, but the scientific logic of it, to me, is more important right now in a patient's situation. In that situation, I would use erlotinib.
Interesting. What do you think about what's going on in terms of adjuvant therapy, not just the trial that they're trying to get? I think it's almost about open of chemo plus or minus bevacizumab. But there's been a lot of controversy now since the last ASCO meeting because of the CALGB study. Can you talk about what your take is on that?
I think it's simply a power situation on that study. And, you know,
can you kind of review that, what the study was and what you mean by the power?
Yes, it was a study in 1B patients only, postoperative Taxol, paclitaxel, carboplatin versus no further treatment. And the study was actually stopped early when they had an interim analysis because the survival looked to be substantially, significantly better. But, of course, with follow-up, it turns out the 5-year survival was not any different, although progression-free survival still favored the chemotherapy. Well, the total number of patients on the trial was relatively small, not statistically appropriate to find a certain survival. So in my view, it's hard to prove this, of course, it's because the power of the study was too small to detect an important clinical difference. Now, some would say, well, it's not that. It's not. There are other studies where 1B patients did not benefit and the studies were larger. And there is truth to that. The ANITA trial, 1B patients did not benefit. And again, some of the same people who say it's carboplatin, that's the reason people didn't benefit. The ANITA trial used cisplatin, and the 1B didn't benefit. Now, the Canadian trial, Dr. Francis Shepherd led that trial. That trial showed a benefit for 1B patients using vinorelbine and cisplatin. It probably related to the size of the tumors. So retrospective subgroup analysis suggests that patients' tumors are 4 centimeters or greater, that they actually do benefit. But that's subset analysis. I think they benefit. It's like colon cancer stage 3 versus stage 2.
Absolutely.
They have a better survival, so it takes more patients to prove the difference.
But you know what you just said? I rarely hear from lung cancer clinical investigators.
Well,
and in fact, my understanding is the adjuvant Bev trial is not going to allow carboplatin. Are you still using it? What
yes.
do you use for adjuvant therapy? I'm guessing it's carboplatin.
Yes. Again, this may not surprise most oncologists or others who know me. I think there's a myth still out there that cisplatin and carboplatin are really different drugs. In my opinion, they're not different, except in rare instances, probably germ cell tumors. There's no major difference in survival of patients. Yes, cisplatin was used in adjuvant trials, and carbo was only used in one small trial that was underpowered. That doesn't mean that cis is better. It just means that it was used. And it's less toxic to use carboplatin. I'm not a proponent of one platinum over another. Overall, I'm a proponent for therapy that helps people that doesn't debilitate them. And in the adjuvant setting after thoracic surgery, I still think that any combination with a platinum, either one, is the same. Now, I'm going to get major argument from some of the purists who've done the studies. That's okay. I can deal with it.
Interesting. It makes a lot of sense. You were using carboplatin before. You're still using it after ASCO.
Yes.
What kind of data, incidentally, getting back to the original NAB thing, would you want to see in order to use carbo-NAB in the adjuvant setting instead of carboplatin? Do you need a phase 3 trial? What do you need?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, I'd like to see, I'd like to see phase 3 data because it's so rigorous when you have that. But the toxicity is not a trivial concern in lung cancer patients. They're older. They have comorbid conditions. They're unlike breast in many ways.
Absolutely.
Plus, they've had major surgery. Not that mastectomy isn't a major surgery, but thoracotomy and lobectomy is a major surgery.
Yep.
And if compliance and delivering treatment is important, the less toxic it is, yet effective, it could be important if you treat hundreds of patients. So, yes, I think that nab-paclitaxel could have a role there because I think the drug is less toxic, particularly with the neuropathy and the chronic neuropathies in the post-op setting. It combines well with platinum agents, so I think it could have a role there, but we need more data.
But what kind of data? For example, how about phase 3 for metastatic disease? Would that be enough to get used in the adjuvant setting?
Yes. Now, again, I may jump perhaps quicker, and some would say too quick, but if I had that data in the metastatic setting, I would translate it in the adjuvant setting. Of course, I would like a study, but that wouldn't stop me from using a less toxic regimen in an individual patient. And that's really what we're talking about, making a decision in an individual patient.
Yeah, you know, and it's really an oncology-wide problem in a number of situations about do you invest research dollars and patient resources to answer questions like NAB versus Taxol or capecitabine versus 5-FU, you know, things that people kind of think maybe are the same, but are we going to do a 3,000-patient study to prove it or not? What do you think?
I don't think it should be done. The FDA requires it for registration, but I think, as you illustrated, it's almost like comparing aspirin with Tylenol. I use that example. Capecitabine and 5-FU is a very good example, or even a better one, capecitabine and infusional 5-FU.
Of course.
To me, that's just kind of a ridiculous thing, and I think it's true for this, too. I'm much more interested in targeted, I'll use the word targeted, adjuvant therapy,
sure,
like bevacizumab plus chemotherapy, than I am continually comparing combinations.
So if, in fact, and maybe you know that this has been decided or not, but if the ECOG adjuvant Bev trial does not allow carboplatin, are you going to participate in it?
Probably not, but I wouldn't participate for other reasons. It's a difficult group of patients to treat with cisplatin, and they allow some regimens that are clearly extremely toxic, so you'd have to select highly selected patients. Most of the patients that I see for adjuvant therapy, and again, this may vary, most that I see are not candidates for cisplatin. So I would have difficulty placing patients on the trial because I wouldn't see that many. They've had arrhythmias postoperatively. They're 73 years old. They need some form of treatment. They're still, but to use cisplatin in that setting is very difficult. So I wouldn't have a whole lot of patients for that trial.
I thought I heard you allude to other reasons you wouldn't participate. I'm kind of curious what they would be. More political, economic, or something?
Yes. The NIH studies, and this is not my opinion alone, are not funded well enough for community oncologists.
Right, I figured that was what that was.
The CTSU mechanism only pays $2,500. It costs more to treat the patient on a clinical trial, follow up, get the information and data. So it's like you're subsidizing. And I don't have any other source of funds to subsidize. So that's a major issue.
Do you think there's enough noise being made about this problem?
No. Of course, I'm biased because I'm in the community setting. Bob Comas, he's been trying to get this change for years, but he's sort of fighting City Hall, in this case, the big City Hall, the government. And he's in charge of ECOG, and he's head of the Coalition of Cooperative Groups. He's a great guy.
It's frustrating.
Frustrating.
Right. So we're going to let industry do our research, I guess, right?
I think 99% is done by industry.
Well, they have got some good stuff done, though. I got to admit, it's not perfect, but they are getting some stuff done.
They're getting something done.
Unfortunately, if something comes out like the WIND study of dietary fat reduction, who's going to pay for that?
Well, that's right. Or even the scan study, the spiral CT scanning.
So we can move cancer forward as long as somebody makes money on it, I guess. What about stage 3 disease, 3B? How do you approach that in terms of chemoradiation therapy?
Yeah, that's a very interesting group because I don't think we can use some of the newer drugs, I call them newer, cytotoxic drugs that we've had now for several years that are more effective, and we know that from stage 4 studies. We can't combine them appropriately with radiation because it's too toxic. Too much toxicity on the esophagus and lung. Therefore, we've had to reduce the doses with concomitant radiation, and it's made it difficult to prove that we've actually given these patients a jump in their survival and particularly their cure rate beyond what we did 15 years ago with what I call second-generation chemotherapy, etoposide cisplatinum or Velbane cisplatinum, concurrently with radiation, concurrently. We know that's better, see?
Right.
So we haven't made the jump yet, but I think that soon we're going to see data where we have made the jump because some of the drugs are going to be able to combine better with radiation. I don't like using posterior chemotherapy. What I mean by that is consolidative Taxotere after cisplatin, etoposide, and radiation. That's that SWOG model.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that study was a highly selective, small study where that came from, and it was accepted as a superior therapy because the NIH allowed it in a large randomized trial. All patients got that treatment, and then they either received gefitinib or ERISA or no ERISA. They showed no difference there. That ERISA in this unselected group didn't make any difference. But that treatment has sort of become ensconced because of that. And I think that set us back a ways. I'm not criticizing the people who designed that trial, but that set us back a ways. That's difficult. The Hoosier Oncology Group has tried to actually show that that's better than just cisplatinum radiation and etoposide, and it's not even feasible for most patients in the community. In other words,
although a lot of that was neutropenia, I think, what I saw there. What do you think?
Well, neutropenia, but also just the overall debility of the patients. Radiation, chemo, and then trying to receive Taxotere in adequate doses. They weren't able to get the doses in. Of course, neutropenia was an issue.
They didn't use, now I think a lot of people, when they do this, use preventive Neulasta, but they didn't.
Yeah, so, there are issues like that. But the point is, the most common patients out there in the community often can't receive this treatment. Plus, it seems like you're waiting too long to use the best drug. Taxotere is better than the other drugs. The reason the other drugs are used is we can't use Taxotere in full dose with radiation, nor Taxol, nor gemcitabine, any of the newer drugs.
Why do you say you're waiting too long? To me, it looks kind of like adjuvant therapy.
Well, yeah, but a lot of the patients drop off before they get a chance to get the superior therapy.
So what specifically, first of all, are you doing in a non-protocol setting right now, and where do you think things are heading?
Yeah. What I do, and again, the data is not totally in yet, I give induction treatment with full doses for 2 courses.
Of what agent or regimen?
Well, for instance, paclitaxel carboplatinum. It's a reasonable, good regimen. Give 2 courses. Then I come in with the radiation with weekly either Taxol or Taxotere and carboplatinum, low doses with the radiation for 6 weeks on a weekly schedule. Then I stop after that. I think that takes advantage of the full dose treatment, which we know is effective, that you can't use with radiation. And there's some data now coming out that would support what I just said. I think the future, however, is going to be with drugs you can use in full dose. And pemetrexed, in my opinion, could fit the bill. It's a very good drug, Alimta, pemetrexed.
Sure.
Used with platinums, carboplatinum, for instance, in my view, looks like from early data can be given in full dose with radiation. If that's true, that could step it up a level because we've got better induction, used in full dose with the radiation. And sorry to prolong this, but
No, it's interesting.
This whole area is an important area.
No, what you're saying makes sense. What about biologics in the future during the radiation?
Well, again, I think Avastin has got to be used in this setting, too. Again, this is an experimental approach right now. We're involved in it in our own studies. And Avastin has to be used with the chemotherapy.
What about with the radiation?
I agree. I think it should be used with it.
What's the study you're doing?
We're about to launch a study with pemetrexed, carboplatin, Avastin, and radiation in the stage 3 patients.
Wow. And is there an induction period?
No. The doses are full doses to begin with. We also have a small cell study.
What's that looking at?
The small cell study looks at irinotecan and carboplatin and Avastin with radiation in the limited setting without radiation in the extensive stage setting. So Avastin is being incorporated, this is a pilot study, phase 2 trial, in small cell lung cancer from day 1 with chemotherapy.
What do we know about the interaction between Avastin and radiation therapy?
We don't know enough, but these data are coming forth clinically. And it does look like, again, we have some early data in the limited stage small cell lung cancer trial already, that the esophagitis and other major local acute toxicity is not enhanced by Avastin.
And I guess in terms of anti-tumor effect, I'm trying to think about what we know. They're doing it in rectal cancer. I'm not sure we really know exactly what it does in rectal cancer during neoadjuvant radiation therapy. What do we know about the anti-tumor potentiation of Bev plus radiation?
I don't think we have much data other than just some preliminary information, you know, in animal data. We really don't have much human data.
You know, it's been interesting following bevacizumab's story in terms of why people think it works, and you hear more now about the, quote, normalization of the vasculature that might allow chemotherapy penetration, but I guess theoretically normalization of the vasculature maybe would make radiation more effective.
True.
I mean, better oxygenation.
Oxygenation.
But I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. What other lung trials are you guys doing right now or involved with?
We have several. Most of the trials that we're doing that we initiated or our investigator-initiated trials are with bevacizumab. I mentioned the stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer program with Alimta, carboplatin, radiation, Avastin. And we have an elderly trial that hasn't been launched yet, but we're soon to launch. Patients, elderly, of poor performance status, two separate groups looking at gemcitabine and Alimta without a platinum with Avastin.
Has gem and pemetrexed been used together?
Yes. We've actually recently submitted an abstract. We had an ASCO abstract last year. Submitted an abstract, and Dr. David Spiegel, associate of mine, presented these data at the Head, Neck, and Lung Symposium in Chicago just a few weeks ago. Every 2 week, gemcitabine and pemetrexed. Others have done this too. Every 2 week schedule, well-tolerated regimen, particularly reasonable, I think, for in elderly patients. So we're doing this with Avastin.
What's the age?
In the elderly age group, over 70.
70. Interesting.
Yeah.
Where do you think the future is going to be for groups like yours that are doing a lot of research but more in a community setting? Do you think that's going to increase or decrease in the next 10 years?
There are a lot of factors that tell me it's going to increase, but there are also factors out there that would reduce our capacity to be able to do this type of work. So it depends on how much that's offset with the positive factor. So overall, I think that the community centers are going to be major. They already are major players, by the way.
Absolutely.
They put half or more of the patients on the cooperative group studies.
And incidentally, the patterns of care studies I was telling you about earlier, we find that 75% of medical oncologists are participating in clinical trials. A lot of that's industry, but 75% are putting patients. Does that sound right to you?
That's very interesting. I didn't realize it was that high, but
it was surprising.
Yeah.
It's not clear, I guess, where this is all heading.
It's not clear to me, but I really think the patients are in the communities. It's unrealistic to expect the majority of patients with cancers to flock into major cancer centers to get trials. Even if 10%, which is a large number, went to the major centers, they would be overwhelmed with patients. That's the first thing. The second thing is that people won't do it. I know that Memorial and MD Anderson get lots of patients, but there are many, many more patients that don't go
right,
there.
Right.
So we have to bring these treatments to the patients in the communities rather than expect the patients to come into centers. And that is alien to the thinking that, first of all, the centers don't want to do that because they continually want to have large numbers of patients come to their place. So they don't want to do it. So how are we going to get over this hump of 4% of all patients or 3% that go on clinical trials? In my view, we're not going to get over that unless we go into the communities and design the research and allow the doctors who are well-trained to be involved.
And get some money.
They have to be paid. You can't do work right for nothing. And when you're doing it and actually being paid less than it costs you, that's obviously ridiculous.